Good morning, brothers and sisters. So I was originally going to speak about Nicodemus today, but I figured, given the weather, that when life gets muddy may be a better topic. So one of the first things that many people learn, one of the first things I learned when I was growing up, is that life isn't fair. It's something your parents tell you early on, and it's something I hated. When something happens and your brother gets something that you don't, or something else happens and you say, "What? Why does that happen? You know, why does my brother get to have a sleepover and I don't?" And they say, "Life isn't fair." And there's nothing you can say back to that. But it's something we have to learn early on because it's just true. Life isn't fair, at least the way we want it to be fair. And it's something we learn a lot and through different lessons in life, not just through our parents. I remember very clearly one of the times I learned this lesson again and again, because you learn it throughout your whole life, was in high school. We had this drill. I played football, and we had this drill called the agility drill. What it was is you start off in the middle, and then there's a cone about 5 yards from you. You run over to one side, touch the cone, run over the other, touch the cone, and run all the way through. And the coach would time you and write down your time. It's supposed to tell you how agile you are. And I was really, I always looked forward to doing this drill because for someone my size, I'm actually pretty good at agility and I was good at that. But also for some reason, we always seem to do this stupid drill at the beginning of the year, right after we watered the field, which means the whole field was covered in mud. And while I may have some good agility, I do not have good balance. So I would get more and more frustrated as I would run this drill, as I would hit one side and then slip there and then try to run back and then slip on the other side and then try to run through. And the harder I tried, the more I would slip. And so I get more and more frustrated. I'd see that coach with the clipboard and I just knew what he was thinking about me, that look at this guy, he can't even stand up straight. How is he going to play football? Luckily, and I would watch the other more athletic kids go through the drill and I would kind of, you know, be down on myself sometimes, and I thought, man, if we just didn't do this drill in the mud, if that would be fair. This isn't fair the way we're doing it. If we just changed the way we did it and just didn't do it in the mud, I would be okay. I somehow still got to play despite this, but it was a lesson to me that it wasn't quite fair. That you, even if you are not good at, sometimes you just have to deal with the circumstances you're given to you, and you can't complain about how things are. Recently, we read Hebrews 11, I mean in the readings, also we read it recently, 5 minutes ago, but something stuck out to me when we did it in the readings, and that has always stuck out to me. It's not the beautiful description of faith, and it's a beautiful, beautiful chapter. It's not the description of all the great acts of faith by Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Enoch and down the line, all these awesome descriptions of how people had faith despite their circumstances. The one thing that has always really stuck out in that chapter to me, and maybe it's just my way of thinking, is why is Samson in there? Samson is this guy in the Bible. He's told he can't drink wine. He can't touch anything unclean. He can't touch dead people. He's given a very specific set of rules, all of which he breaks. Beyond that, practically all of his life, Samson seems to be an example of worldly thinking, putting himself above other people. He visits prostitutes, he wagers money, he murders people, he lies, he's an arsonist, all within about 3 short chapters that he's in. And yet, here he is in Hebrews 11. It doesn't expand on it, but they put him in there as an example of faith, as an example we look up to on what faith means. So even though he seems to be an abject failure in following all of God's commandments in, you know, ideally the way we'd want to, he's still in there as our example. So where does this fit in? So today I wanted to look at exactly a little bit of fairness and how it pertains to righteousness. Or maybe a better way to put it, because God judges us all, is how does God judge us? What, maybe getting a glimpse of just a tiny bit of what fairness means to God, because if we're just looking at actions, it's not necessarily fair, maybe, that Samson is given us as an example of righteousness or faithfulness and others aren't. So in terms of people being chosen for the service of God out of the blue, just choosing people, I think the 12 disciples are a good place to start. Now, the 12 disciples are not necessarily perfect people to begin with. Peter has a bark that doesn't always match his bite. James and John's mom, of all people, asked Jesus to put her sons above all the other disciples. Thomas doubts several times. Philip has one test listed in the Bible, and he fails that test. And I don't even want to get started on Judas. These men are imperfect men. But God definitely loves something about them. They come from all walks of life, all different places, and there's something about them that despite their flaws and despite their failures, he loves about these men. So to take a look at that, I want to take a look at an example of two of the disciples. Judas and Peter are good examples of men who had every reason to believe that they could be not failures in the eyes of the Lord. Peter was zealous for his master, and his actions prove it. He's the first to step out on the water when Jesus tells people to come. He's the first to declare that Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of the living God. Judas, too, remember, is one of the disciples. He follows Jesus around. Judas, too, has given up everything to be with Jesus. In fact, Judas is so trusted that he's made the keeper of the money for Jesus' ministry. That is a position you give to somebody that you trust. So both of them are zealous people, and they have every reason to believe that they are good disciples. And yet, they both slip, and they both slip horribly. So reading out of Luke 22, I'm going to read, it's actually from the same chapter about both of their mistakes. I'm going to start in Luke 22, 3 through 5, and then I'm going to go on to Luke 22, 54 through 62. And I'll read it here. You don't necessarily need to follow on, but if you want to, it's there. Luke 22, 3 through 5. Then Satan entered into Judas, called Iscariot, who is one of the number of the 12. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers how he might betray him to them. And they were glad, and they agreed to give him money. So there's Judas. Not really sure why Judas does this. The Bible doesn't fully explain. It talks about Judas's greed. That could be a reason. It talks about Judas's ideology. Maybe Judas goes away because he starts to disagree with Jesus or his own pride. It doesn't really say. Going on to Peter, Luke 22, 54 through 62. This is directly after Judas betrays Jesus, actually. Then they seized Jesus and led him away, bringing him to the high priest's house, and Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and they sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light, looked closely at him and said, "This man was also with him." But he denied it, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You are also one of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, said, "Certainly, this man was also with him, for he is also a Galilean." But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are talking about." And immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. So, despite the motivations of these men, it could be ideology, there's certainly fear mixed in, there could be greed, could be jealousy of Jesus and Judas's part, there's all sorts of different ideas, but they certainly fall by any sense of the word. They fall down. They make a mistake that is horrible, and they make mistakes for the reason that are very familiar to us. Even if we can't understand Judas's actions, we understand jealousy and we understand greed. And we certainly understand Peter's fear and why he does what he does. They don't pass this test that's put upon them. And they not only fail, but they abandon the Son of God of all people right when he needs them the most. Jesus' own words must have been ringing in Peter's head after he denies Jesus. "Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven." Again, by any stretch, there's the rule. If you deny me before others, then I will deny you before the Father in heaven. And Peter has thrice denied Jesus. Can you imagine how they would have felt? Both of them, actually, as we see in the Bible. The Bible demonstrates that both of them feel horrible. Talk about being a failure. I don't know if you've ever felt or hurt someone in a way that was very bad. I know I have. I've done it to the point where I was retching over a toilet. I was throwing up almost just because of the feeling of it. And how much more so would it be for Peter and for Judas? Could you imagine those 3 days for Peter? Knowing that's the last, you know, that's the last interaction he had with Christ, is denying him 3 times. The man he pledged his life to, that over and over, that he followed for 3 years. It must have been torture. We don't believe in hell, but I think that's about as close as you can get to it, is how they would have felt. But I think what we see in these men, even though they fail, even though they do fall, that's not what God's looking for from them. And the reason I choose both of them is because they react differently, and it shows what God loves in us. Peter does not give up. Despite being in the lowest place he's ever been in his life, and perhaps one of the lowest place any human has ever been in, he doesn't give up. He's given another chance. He sticks around. He stays with the disciples. He runs to Jesus, to the tomb when he hears it's empty. And when he gets another chance, he takes it with a passion characteristic of who Peter is. Reading from John, John 21, therefore that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. And this is when Jesus appears to the disciples after he is risen. And Jesus appears and the disciple whom Jesus loves says to Peter, it is the Lord. Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea. The other disciples came in a little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with the fish. So only about 100 yards out, but Peter cannot wait to see Jesus. He jumps in the water. The other disciples are like, we can just wait to get there dry. But Peter jumps into the water and swims. He doesn't care about anything else. And to me, this explains why Peter is so beloved by the Lord. He had every reason to run away from Jesus or to avoid him. Again, if you've ever done something bad to somebody, you know you don't always want to see them the next day. He has every reason to let his own sin and his own failure come between him and his master. Yet Peter, without hesitation, comes as quickly as possible. He doesn't care that Jesus might rebuke him. He doesn't care about the consequences in between him and Jesus. He doesn't care about his own shame and guilt between him and Jesus. When he sees that chance, he takes it, despite all the risks and despite how much pain it's caused him. It couldn't have been an easy process. In fact, it was a very painful process for Peter when he does get to shore. Because Jesus asks Peter about his love and devotion 3 times, and each of the 3 times must have felt like a dagger to the heart of Peter. In fact, the last time, the Bible specifically describes Peter being grieved or very hurt by the words of Jesus. But still, Peter put his life on his master's, and he knew that Jesus would forgive him. He had faith that he would forgive him. Even though Peter had fallen, he trusted in the love of Jesus and trusted in the love of God and his master. It's a hard thing to do, to keep on getting up when we fall down. Once during a tough period, I was told by a friend, you know, while I was trying to get through something, I was told by a friend, all I had to do is at the beginning of the day to tell myself that I would get through the day just one more time. Just one more time. And I was like, yeah, well, that's great, but what happens when I get through the day? Like, I have a whole bunch of days like this. I was like, how do I get through, you know, I'll get through that one day, and then I'll have to keep on going. And my friend said, I was like, so what happens when I wake up the next morning? And my friend said, don't worry about down the line. Just when you wake up the next morning, you say, just get through this day one more time. Because if you wake up and say that every day, you're going to get through all that stuff. Just one more time, one day at a time. That's what he was telling me. The thing is, Peter didn't have to react this way. And we look at Peter sometimes and be like, oh, of course he's going to swim towards Jesus. Of course he's going to keep on going. That's not how everyone reacts. In fact, that's not the way most people react. There are always other ways. As my dad would say, there's always, always a choice in anything you do. Reading out of Matthew 27. Then when Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he changed his mind and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. They say, what is that to us? See to it yourself. And throwing down the pieces of silver into the temple, he departed and went and he hanged himself. There is always a choice. God never, ever gives up on us. I truly believe no matter what sin we do, including Judas's. Because to say God can't forgive Judas's sin would be putting limits on his power and his love. God never gives up on us, but we can give up on us. And not just in doing by doing what Judas did, not just by killing yourself, but in a million other ways. We can tell ourselves we're already given to that sin, so there's no point in fighting it. We're already this bad person anyway. We can tell ourselves that God doesn't want to see us the way we are because we're a bad person. So we don't come. Maybe sometimes you even tell yourself God doesn't exist because you're running from the fact of what you've done and you're running from the consequences of what you've done. All these things are giving up on God and giving up on his power and his love. Because there is no sin on heaven and earth that can permanently separate us, and only giving up for us can do that. So looking at Peter's choice and what he did, I wanted to quickly go to another one of my favorite Bible people and see how he reacted in a similar situation. Similar not as in he denied Jesus three times, but doing something that was perhaps even made him feel guiltier. So going back to the same theme, I'll pose another question. How was King David a man after God's own heart? Especially after he used his own power to lie, the power that God gave him, in fact, to lie, to commit adultery, and to murder. We know that David was the most powerful king in Israel there ever was and ever will be until Jesus came. And at one point in his life, instead of going out with his army, he stays home. If there's any of you that don't know the story, while he stays at home, he sees this woman on a roof, and her beauty and the moonlight kind of overthrow his thinking, and he invites her in. And basically, the catch is this woman, Bathsheba, the catch is she's already married, and to make a long story short, he kills her husband to cover up his crime. But of course, God can see it because God sees everything. And God eventually confronts David on the sin. For the purposes of what we're looking at, though, it's not important in looking at what he actually did, perhaps only that we know it's an abhorrent sin. In every sense of the word, what he did is abhorrent. Not only did he lie, but he used the power God gave him to do that. And that's something Nathan the prophet brings up when he confronts confronts David. So if we're looking purely as a scoreboard type thing, this is a big minus on David's score in terms of judgment, if that's how God were to judge. But that's not what God says. God says, David is a man after my own heart. So I think what makes David a man after God's own heart isn't in his failure, but in what he does afterwards. He writes a psalm afterwards. It's one of my favorite psalms, especially if you're feeling down, or especially if you're in this position like Peter or David. Psalm 51. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness. According to the multitude of your tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin, for I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire the truth in the inward parts, and in the hidden part you will make it known to wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter as snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold me by your generous spirit. Then I'll teach the transgressors of your ways. And sinners shall be converted to you. Deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God, the God of my salvation. And my tongue shall sing aloud of your righteousness, O Lord. Open my lips, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. For you do not desire sacrifice, else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. David, in this, interestingly, he doesn't pity himself. He doesn't beat himself up for what he did. He doesn't hide from God. He certainly acknowledges how horrible what he did was. In fact, he says, from the second I was conceived by my mother, I was brought forth in sin. He humbles himself as much as he can. He said, I can't give any sacrifice. There's no sacrifices I could possibly give up to everything in my whole kingdom that would make up for this sin, except for a broken heart and a contrite spirit. Instead, what David does and why he is a man after God's own heart is he asks to be forgiven. He asks for something that he does not deserve. He tells God to give him joy again. Could you imagine right after you've done something so bad, you ask for joy from God? You ask for peace from God. You ask for a pure heart and a clean spirit. Because by doing this, David is actually showing faith. He's acknowledging the power of God and the love of God by doing this, by getting up instead of beating himself up, instead of going a different direction, by coming back to God, he's showing true humility. By giving up, we acknowledge neither the power of love or the love of God. We don't acknowledge the power in saying that he can't bring us up from this failure, and we don't acknowledge the love of God by saying he won't bring us up from this failure. You can imagine how far David has fallen and what he feels like. But he comes back, as always, to his rock, his strong tower, and his deliverer every single time. Throughout his whole life, you read the Psalms, you see what David does, and he fails a lot. This isn't the only time David does something wrong or foolish. But what makes David special isn't that he's perfect or not that he doesn't fail. It's that he always comes back, and you can read it in his Psalms and Psalm 51, and throughout all of his Psalms, he always comes back to trust in God, his rock, his deliverer, his strong tower. As he says himself, a broken and contrite heart is the type of sacrifice God loves. And this heart, the broken and contrite one, is the heart that is after God's own. There's no measure for how much sin counts against us. There's no sin, you can't say there's some sin that can leave us out of the kingdom or some sins are worse than others per se, because that's not exactly how it works. That's not how God judges us. God is a good judge. As it says in Samuel, people look for the outward appearance, but God searches in the heart. He looks not only at the deeds we do, but where our heart is at the time. Because if he only looked at the deeds we do, many of these people revere in the Bible probably wouldn't make the cut if it was just by how horrible the things you've done in your life, including David, including Peter, Judas certainly, and many of the other people, Samson. And I think this is the same for Samson looking back at him. Because what God sees in Samson is not the man given to his own pride, his own strength, and to his own sin. He sees a man who, with his last act, rid his people, his land, of an oppressing people. And to me, the fact that he is in Hebrews 11 sheds new light for me on the story of Samson. Because the fact that Samson is counted as this example of faith, along with these other people who sought for things that they would never see, shows me part of Samson's motivation in Judges. To me, that shows me that Samson trusted that God would redeem him and trusted in some sort of resurrection. Because when he killed himself, he knew that God would still save him. He still had that faith in him. And I believe Samson had that full knowledge in even though he was going to push down those walls, he was doing it for the good of God, and that was not the end of Samson's story. We can read in the epistles of Paul that it is impossible to be saved by works, and likewise, I believe it is impossible to be condemned by works. God certainly looks at our deeds, but as an extension of our heart. We are saved by our continued faith in the love of God and the mercy of us coming back to him. So it was funny, actually, going back to my story at the beginning, because I learned a little bit more about that stupid muddy football drill, because I had a chance to be a coach later on for that same team. And years later, I'm a coach for the same team, and lo and behold, they're doing this agility drill again, and they're doing it in the mud again while I'm a coach this time, so it's a little less frustrating. So I'm like, oh, got to do this ridiculous thing again, and we have all the kids line up, and they're doing it, and I'm standing next to the other coach with that same clipboard, and I look over, and I notice he actually hasn't written anything down. And I was like, you haven't written anything down. What, like, how are you supposed to know their times? And he's like, I don't care about their agility times. And I said, what? And he said, okay, watch this next kid. I was one of the more athletic kids on the team. And he gets started, and he goes to one side, and then he does it perfectly. He plants off, goes to the other side fast, and he kind of slips on this side. And then he's like, okay, this is over. And so he just kind of runs through. He jogs all the way through, and it's like, okay. Well, it didn't work out that time. And then I watch, and the next kid comes up. He's a little less athletic. He's not the fastest kid on the team or the most agile kid on the team. And he comes up, and he goes to one side, and immediately he slips. But then he keeps on. He gets up again and runs as fast as he can to the other side, and he slips again. But then instead of jogging through, he runs as fast as he can through the other side. And then I got it, because what the coaches were looking for was not the agility. They weren't looking for how good or athletic a player was. The whole time, they were not looking for whether the player fell down, but whether the player got up again and kept on going. It's something we call in football coaching speak, they were looking for heart, is what they would say. To me, it was a good lesson, because this is largely how I believe, in many parts, how God views our journeys when he looks at us. We all go through all sorts of trials and tests and temptations and different trials, and God tests us to our ability. And I do believe God puts us through these circumstances in much the same way the coaches put us in that muddy patch and made us run around in circles. Often we go through life discouraged at our failure, or discouraged at our progress. We don't have enough progress in our relationships or our careers or our families or even our spiritual life. I don't know enough about the Bible, and we feel like we're failures in that. But I believe we're not looking at these things like God looks at them. He doesn't put us in these trials or temptations. He doesn't put us in these muddy patches expecting us to not fall, because he made us and he knows we are going to. He puts us there looking to see whether we're going to stand up again. He puts us there to see if we're going to go to him when we do fall, because at times we all will, and he puts us in situations that will make us at some times. So if you're going through a trial or a temptation now, or you will in the future, and if you're feeling you are being tempted or tested beyond what you can bear, know that God is going to provide you a way of escape, and know that God isn't looking for you to be perfect, and he's not looking for you to fall. He's looking at what you do after you fall. He's looking at how you react. And like my dad said, you always, always have a decision. You can stay down, or just one more time after you fall, you can get back up.